Hello, everybody.
Good morning. Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Susan.
People are saying welcome already. This is December 7th, 2020, and this is episode 132 of Transmission.
132.
132.
3210.
Blast off.
Hey, James. So I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing.
I'm Mark Van Steenwijk. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And so things are starting to shift, right? The vaccines are rolling out all over the world. It's really kind of funny to me how there's this whole geopolitical aspect of this, right? I was just reading a bunch of stuff this morning. So, you know, there's the Chinese vaccine that's starting to roll out that just got shipped to Indonesia. They got 1.3 million doses. And then there's the Indian vaccine, and that's getting ready to roll out in India. And then, of course, you got the Russian vaccine. Countries in Eastern Europe are maybe going to buy that. And then you've got the multiple Western European American vaccine. So I find that to be kind of interesting. Like, you know, then the countries will probably say, well, our vaccine's better than your vaccine. I'm sure that will come along.
Well, and Putin and his crew came out with theirs first because they were Russian.
Okay. All right.
It's Monday. That's how I wake up.
Yeah. So anyway, what this heralds, you know, is that there could be a change coming. Like, if these things actually work and don't have side effects on a significant scale once we start vaccinating lots and lots of people. But, you know, here in the States, they're talking about starting to vaccinate healthcare workers next week. Somebody really liked your pun.
I'm assuming this is for the pun.
Yeah.
Let's hope so.
And that person also has a robot bird in their little picture. That's something else I was thinking about.
We have not talked about robot birds.
I think they should use the robot birds to distribute the vaccine. I mean, that just seems like the obvious, quickest way to do it. Because there's robot birds everywhere.
Although soon they'll be able to mass produce robot mosquitoes that can inject you without your consent.
Yeah, they'll just be preloaded with the vaccine.
Yeah.
Gosh, can you imagine wanting to be bitten by a mosquito? Be all new thing.
All those terrified anti-vaxxers staying in their hermetically sealed homes.
Yeah. And anyway, so that got us, all of this got us thinking about, well, what are things going to be like after the pandemic? And we thought we'd talk a little bit about the church after the pandemic, because certainly the church has, like many things, has been under stress during this time. And so, Mark, you were doing some historical research.
I was. You know, there's this. In the past when we've talked about this, we've largely framed it in terms of adaptation. So you have these churches that don't even have strong social media presences, having to shift to like becoming a Zoom church. And that's been the big shift. But to me, it's more interesting to talk about, there's already some sociological and theological shifts before the pandemic, and how those shifts will continue and where things are at a macro level. And I was reading up on different plague responses in the late 1300s, when the big one, the Black Death, came through. there was the general framework was that the church said this is punishment for sin, which we still get that. It's fascinating. Fascinating how that isn't a dominant narrative right now. Because that the idea of it being a hoax is counter narrative to the idea of it being a judgment from God. So that's a fascinating shift. Because in the past, I mean, AIDS was a punishment from God, but this one isn't for some reason. So that's fascinating. But during that time, they said that, and that the response was to engage in penance because this is a punishment from God. And also it was generally assumed that if your city was hit with a plague, the best thing for you to avoid this judgment was to go to a place where the air was cleaner, because cleaning out the air was seen as the health remedy, which hastened the spread. Now, in the Islamic world, if my research, I'm not a Islamicist and I don't know like medieval history super well, but the general sense was that this was God's will. It was actually a mercy, because if God hastens your death and calls you to heaven, it's a type of martyrdom and you're blessed. And therefore, if the plague hits your city, you should just stay put. And because of that, the spread was contained. And so the post-medieval Islamic world was better off than the Christian world, based upon their different views of God. Now, it's fascinating to reverse engineer different responses to this plague and say, well, if you had to guess what someone's view of God was based upon how we're acting, what would that be? Mm-hmm. And what's shifting in people's understanding of God and faith because of this?
Well, yeah, and actually for a lot of that, we don't have to guess, right? And I was also sharing that a friend of mine posted this letter that Martin Luther wrote in 1527 in response to a plague, where he actually outlined people's behaviors that he was seeing around him. And it, you know, it was remarkably similar to what we're seeing today. Apparently there were a number of people that just wanted to ignore the plague and said that, you know, God would either protect them or kill them. And that was up to God and they were going to do whatever they wanted. Been hearing a lot of that. And Martin Luther was advising against that attitude, saying that that was a sin because you were tempting and testing God. And so he was advising taking medicine, staying at home, avoiding places where the plague was spreading. And so I found that, yeah, very interesting. And you know, these responses and how we deal with the realities we find ourselves in really do tell us a lot about our theology, our images of God. And then also, what is the purpose of the community, right? Yes. So that's a whole other side of this, right, is that until pretty recently, it was the church and church organizations that that administered hospitals, you know, homes for widows, orphans, all those kinds of places. Now, of course, now we don't really tend to think of the church as doing any of that. And, you know, that was a big function of the church during plagues. And so, you know, now the church didn't really have to do those kinds of things during this plague. And, you know, then you know, what comes next and what comes after this, especially as a lot of pastors, religious organizations, different church bodies have been extremely stressed by this time.
It's interesting to think about. Like, I'm not saying every hospital should be administered by a church. Like, that's not what I'm going with this. But it is interesting that when it was that way, the assumption was that the church's the works of mercy were predominantly done by the church, and the state wasn't really about that, right? Various states. And because of that, there was a sort of witness to that. That's why it used to be like this saying of when you do a good deed, that it was the Christian thing to do, was such a commonplace phrase that doesn't make sense anymore. Because it's not the church that engages in the primary works of hospitality and the works of mercy anymore. And it's not as though the need for mercy and compassion have dried up because the government's done such a bang up job. But for some reason, the church doesn't really step into that role anymore. So this question of the church's witness like one of the debates in the medieval plague time was, did it hurt the church to go through the plague because the church leadership were such dicks about it, saying this is your own fault for sin? Or was it helped by the fact that basically any hospitaling that happened was done by the church? And so this time, like, we're going through this, and if anything, the dominant narrative is that the church is making this worse. And even the mainline, like, we can say the mainline's different, but it's not like anyone's pointing to the United Church of Christ or the ELCA as, like, helping alleviate the problem. It's not even on people's radar, if they're doing anything at all. And most of those, like, mainline churches, they're basically social engagement wings, are social services that are people link more towards government stuff than somehow church witness. So it's an interesting place to be in, like, okay, what is the witness here?
Yeah. Well, what the church itself internally is often most worried about, what I'm mostly hearing about is, are we going to lose money because people aren't going to give? So the church has mostly been worried about self-preservation. But let's go. We've got some comments coming in.
Back to the important task of the robot birds. I don't think Metalarks are good robots. They refuse cities and busy spaces. Yeah, those were early models from the government.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, that's why they do make good robots, because you think they're not good robots.
Inception. Kathleen writes, there are already wild rumors about potential side effects of vaccine.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. I mean, there's always, I mean, it's right to be a little bit.
Well, side effects and beyond. I mean, a friend of mine said, if he hears one more person talk about vaccines giving you microchips, he's going to start running down the street screaming. So, yeah, all kinds of good stuff in that regard.
Wow. Sergius writes, how do they make robot birds and mosquitoes if many nations spend so much money on military weaponry?
Well, how do you know that the robot birds and mosquitoes are not part of the military weaponry?
They multitask. They can inject you, but they also can explode. So, like, if you get a little mosquito one, flies into your nose and explodes, boom. People don't know they exploded. It just gives them an aneurysm. So that's what the government does. The robot birds, you know.
Well, and the robot birds and mosquitoes can serve as, guidance systems for other weapons.
Yeah, the bird lands in the house. That's the target house. Yeah. And then they send the scud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's all part of the same thing, Ceres. I mean, come on. Get it together.
We just bird-splain Ceres. Kathleen writes, I think many people have learned that we don't actually need traditional churches. This is the other piece that's interesting to watch. For me, this group has become a new type of faith community.
Yeah. Well, right. And, you know, and this is something I think that is really a big aspect of all of this, right? Those that have been involved in the mainline church know that for decades now, the church has been saying it's got to change, it's got to embrace technology, it's got to do different things, it's got to reach people in different ways. And by and large, the churches have been summarily ignoring all of that. And, you know, you've got these, like, either tired or very happy rich church consultants that have been running around all over the place, you know, saying all this stuff and being ignored for a long time. And right. And now the pandemic, like, forced people to do all this thing. I mean, I've been trying to get my presbytery to meet virtually for literally 20 years. And I would go to meetings and say, you know, there's this thing called the internet. Like, we could meet online. We wouldn't have to worry about 80-year-old ladies driving through snowstorms across North Dakota. And everybody's like, no, we can't do that. It's impossible. Well, then the pandemic hit, and then we met online. Everybody's like, wow, this is kind of cool. Right. So, yeah, I mean, people are finding that the reach of their community, the type of their community, the way communities are being organized is all shifting. And so one of the questions is, right, so after we can go back to meeting in person, how much of a pull is there going to be to just, you know, go back to normal versus how much of a pull is there going to be to say, well, you know, a lot of these new things were great and I want to keep doing that. And maybe I'll do some stuff, you know, in person and like I used to, but I don't want to lose the positive things that we've figured out during this time.
Well, and it seems to me that if a church's primary offering to the world was a monologue and some singing, then you don't really need to go to a church for that. Like the monologue you can, and we already had this before with people tuning into television for sermons instead, or getting mm-hmm. sermon series via audio tape or listening to the podcast. This is already a phenomenon, but to me it raises the question like, okay, we could lament that and start doing this arms race for better communication. Or we can say, look, this, you're right, that is something that can be offered in different ways. And so instead, our church is going to emphasize things that you cannot get by sitting down looking at a screen for half an hour. What an opportunity to start discerning what does it mean to be the church in a way that actually adds value to someone's life instead of shaming them. This is one of the funny, interesting things about how I'm pretty sure the mainline will accelerate in its decline. I don't think the evangelical church is going to accelerate just yet, even though we all wish it were true. Because the evangelical church has been the one saying, let's keep meeting anyways. Like they're more likely to flout this and emphasize not only is going to church then for you, but if you go to church, it's an act of defiance against the libtards, against a Stalinist government. And so there's a little bit more teeth to that. And it doubles down into the toxic center of what evangelicalism has always been about, which is a reaction against scary forces from the outside.
Mm-hmm. So anyways. Yeah. You know, and I mean, to reflect very directly, Kathleen, on what you're talking about, I mean, from the other side, right? So from my side, as somebody that does sermons and regular church worship, you know, this half hour, well, it's usually always more like 40 minutes, is way more fun from my point of view. I mean, it's really fun having somebody else to interact with as a primary idea person. Mm-hmm. And then it's super fun having all of you that comment and ask questions and interact. And so as far as a period of time during which we are reflecting on things that have meaning in the world, I find this far superior to delivering sermons. And, if I had to make a choice between the two things, I would pick this every time.
More comments. Maria writes, I don't disagree with people's idea that calamities are a judgment for sin. I do disagree with what sin is being judged.
I mean, well, that's always one of the issues, right? When you think there's judgment for sin, you have to pick which sins you think are being judged. And yeah, there's always a lot of disagreement around that.
No. It's like, to me, it's always been funny to me, because as a parent, I know that if I'm going to like put limitations or things that my son might perceive as a punishment, the punishment has to fit the crime. So like if Jonas is like getting talking back to me whenever I tell him to get off screen, then it makes sense to limit his screen time. But for some reason, God doesn't work that way, because for some reason, if there's a lot of gay people and abortions, God sends a respiratory pandemic. Well, that's always been funny to me. Like, oh, I'm going to gay people there, I'm going to send a hurricane. I'm like, that has nothing to do with that. That's not good parenting.
Yeah.
So it's been interesting to me. I wish I knew how to pronounce your name. So I'm not going to try. Do you want to give a shout out?
Try Beth.
Beth?
No, okay. I'm not going to try.
Sorry. I want to respect your name and not butcher it. So what about all the Christians spreading disease? Where's the church to deal with bad actors? I mean, yeah, I wish.
Well,
that's been one of the biggest disappointments.
We've had a lot of issues with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, right now, you know, over the last several months, church is one of the biggest sources of community spread. Just read an article yesterday about a wedding in Washington State where they've now tracked 7 people who have died as a result of this wedding, none of whom were at the wedding. Right, so it's just secondary spread. It's like, would you really want that as a memory of your wedding? Like, our wedding killed 7 people that weren't even there.
They were all going to die of the flu anyway.
Yeah, right.
This would, yeah.
All right, moving on.
Kathleen writes, as a pastor, one of my biggest responsibilities was hospital visitation. The pandemic totally took that away. Several of my parishioners died alone. I'm not sure how this has affected us.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that, right. I mean, that was one of the kind of few functions. And early on, I actually did a webinar on this with a couple of other folks. You know, I think that there are so many ways in which we have handled this poorly. But certainly one of the things that this revealed is a lot of how we feel about spiritual care and whether or not that's even a real thing. And so, yeah, I mean, the decisions early on for hospitals to exclude pastors, it was a very telling decision about really the value of that work. And I think that is something that is very much worth spending some time reflecting on. What do we bring to those kinds of visits? What is the value of that? And how do we want to talk about that, assert that, etc.? Yeah.
So it's the American church complains about government doing works of mercy, yet they don't do shit. And when they do, it often promotes codependency, burnout, and martyr syndrome.
Right.
It's right. Yeah, it's one of the biggest con games that I used to say as a conservative that somehow, like, I believed that if we didn't have to pay taxes, we would just use all that to be charitable and that we'd be better at it than the government, which I've never seen, unfortunately, to be true in my lifetime. So it just seems like a shell game.
Well, no, it's not. It's not true. And a colleague of mine who's a sociologist actually set out to study this, right? And to say, well, okay, what does the church provide? Because there's all this stuff out there like, well, the church provides care, the church helps the poor, the church does social justice, the church, does all these great things in society. And, so he set out to study, like, do they actually do this to any greater extent than any other organization or group of people? And what he found was that the church actually does none of those things. The only thing that he could find that was a legitimate activity that the church provided was a way for amateur musicians to do music. That was the one thing. So singing in choirs and playing piano and organ, like, that was the one thing the church actually does. And most of it's really bad music. So that's something to meditate on.
Maria writes, the church in the medieval era had a better infrastructure than local governments. They had better means to set up hospitals, etc. I mean, it seems like a mixed bag. I mean, I don't know if I am totally on page with it, but I remember when Bernie Sanders was proposing shifting local clinics to being municipal clinics. And to me, that shows kind of part of the issue. So for some reason, we went from church-based hospitaling to marketplace hospitaling, where the income is the bottom line. And there were some places for a while that, you'd have municipal clinics where they have a mandate to serve the common good. And I do think there's something powerful about, as screwed up as the medieval church was, that they assumed it was part of their mandate to do these works of mercy. And they had a really messed up way of understanding sin and disease, but they kind of got it done within the framework the best way they could, in a way that I feel like we should at least try to do better than that.
Yeah,
as the church today.
Well, and to me, the other place in our society that has had a similar kind of conundrum because of its success, actually, are labor unions. Mm-hmm. Right. So early on, the labor movement was very powerful in terms of advocating for and taking care of working people in very helpful and concrete ways, right? When there wasn't a 40-hour work week, when there weren't any, you know, labor protections, when there wasn't any decent wage, when people were in company towns. I mean, all of those, the labor movement became very powerful in terms of really asserting for workers' rights and taking care of stuff. And they were incredibly successful over time. And then all of those functions got subsumed into law and by the government. And now there are a lot of labor unions that, you know, they're not actually being very helpful in a lot of ways. And part of it is they're a victim of their own success. And so I think we could see the church that way. Okay, so the church has actually been very successful. I mean, one of the reasons that the church had a better infrastructure for care in the medieval time is that they wanted to do it, and the government didn't want to do it. So they didn't even try to make any infrastructure, and the church was interested. And so they created this largely through monastic communities. Mm-hmm. And now the, you know, yeah, government and business has taken that over, and they said, yeah, we want to do that. That's great. Same with education. And so now the church is at this place of like, well, okay, well, what do we do now that all of those functions have been taken over? And again, it's a very fascinating thing to reflect on if we really get serious about reflecting on it, as opposed to just being worried about, you know, why don't we have enough members, and why aren't people here on Sunday morning, and why aren't people coming to our potlucks, which to me are all pretty trivial questions.
Especially the food at most potlucks. It's
kind of not as exciting. Some of them are good, but I mean, you don't need a church to have a potluck.
That's true. Susan writes, crazy conspiracy theories floating around because of the mRNA facet of vaccines.
I know. mRNA seems to have like gotten people's imagination. I don't know, maybe because it's like this cool, mysterious molecule. Maybe we need to call it something else. Mystery like bird RNA. Feathers or something. Mystery RNA. There we go.
Yeah. Ceres writes, and unreciprocal relationships. Talking about the one, going back to the comment about
care.
Or care. Lack thereof. Martyr syndrome and burnout. That's right. Faith writes, driving me crazy are the flurry of emails and social media posts about growing your church's online presence. While I'm okay with online stuff, it feels hollow in the midst of this great suffering. I can't even look at them anymore.
Right, exactly. I mean, and that's the other thing about the church after the pandemic is I think we're going to have to deal with a huge amount of pastoral burnout and exhaustion because yeah, pastoral activity has just been caught up in that market-driven approach. It's like what you're talking about, Faith. Like, okay, so now they've just jumped on board with, okay, great, you know, get your cool online camera and turn your church into a movie studio and do all of this. And you know, and it's all focused around, you know, market share, membership growth, get more money. I mean, and yeah, it's exhausting.
Gus writes, there's a mainline church that I work with that has transformed itself under the closure into a food distribution center for my org and another half dozen food justice orgs. It's a church that's just gray hair, so I'm curious what it'll turn into in the next decade.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, and I think that, I mean, what that model brings up is something that a friend of mine who's actually a nun talks about, right? Because she's looking at, you know, her convent dying and most monastic communities dying in this country. And she said, yeah, it's not about us necessarily doing something new. I mean, we're all like 80, 90 years old and getting ready to die. But the question is, can we be open and creative enough to serve as a legacy, as a springboard for what comes next with the resources, the wisdom that we have? And, you know, that to me is a very powerful model for the whole question of what comes next, because yeah, the vast majority of mainline churches in America are exactly what you're talking about, Gus. It's, you know, I think the average age of the Presbyterian member right now is like it's getting up towards 70, or maybe it's over 70. And so, right, what's the legacy? There's a huge amount of resources tied up in these organizations, and how can we move forward?
Leah writes, love the observation that the works of mercy have been taken over by government. Leads me to wonder if we need to find new ways to embody mercy. Churches seem more interested in judgment and money than mercy. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I get it how it'd be maybe interesting if the church was like handling all the medical care of the world and doing a better job, but like that's not likely to happen. And there's other ways of doing mercy. Like, this is why the Catholic worker has been so important to me, because shelters and government agencies offering housing really can only go so far. It's hard for them to do love and mercy. Like, they just kind of like, it's about human warehousing at that level. And so the Catholic worker is in this example of doing hospitality and kindness that the church doesn't really do much in. There's all kinds of areas of life where people need compassion. Like, we might have hospitals everywhere now, but you have to pay out of pocket more and more. And we have more alienation and mental health issues than ever. And I don't see the church really, there's just not enough money in it for the church to get engaged those things. Like, our addiction to money and wanting to maintain infrastructure and all this stuff, really, we need to acknowledge that this stuff is so predominant, like the emphasis, not because we're trying to figure out how to have money to serve people. It's just we're worried about our own survival. Because we can find ways to serve people whether we have money or not.
All right, so we're over time. Let's roll through. We got a lot of comments. Thank you so much.
Kevin writes, some of the mainline churches have modeled good masks and social distancing behavior, and at the same time, those for or against masks have further divided the church.
Yep, sadly.
Allison writes, 80-year-old men driving in snowstorms are just as vulnerable.
Yes, thank you. That is true.
Susan writes, I think this shift to virtual can be a good thing across various needs, better for the climate. Collaboration across different geopolitical areas can actually be enhanced. I'm researching this now.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, you look at the people on this thread, we could not be gathered in person once a week, even once a month. And yeah, we can do this every day. It's cool.
It does not help that many, at most 40% of the population, has insecure attachment disorder, which makes doing anything in person sucks. Susan writes, I considered church to be able to witness the Minneapolis uprising through virtual sharing by you guys. I considered it church. Adam writes, you'd have to know the mind of God and what is worthy of judgment at all to think calamities are a judgment for sin. By the time you think punishment is justified, you're already casting judgment.
Yes.
I mean, this is where, you know, I think thinking about how we respond to things in ways that show compassion and love are way more interesting than trying to figure out, like, who's guilty.
Who's being zapped by what.
And to me, this is where judgment comes in, like... I'm pretty sure God, if God's pissed at anything, it's Christians slowing down recovery and care because of stubbornness and obstinacy. But that's just my guess. If I had to like pick something for God to judge. Catherine writes, based on what I'm seeing from the ELCA, at least, a lot of mainline congregations are also struggling with members voting to meet in person, yes, despite the pandemic. And it's raising a lot of questions about what church means to church people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's disturbing. And I've been hearing things from different congregations too. And then a lot of, I've also heard of bishops or different judicatory middle management type people just kind of going along with stuff because they're afraid of the money flow. So they kind of are way more tolerant of this than they would otherwise be. Patricia writes, as my pastors in my small rural church, it's the two oldest women who are pushing for us to return in person.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of that is just a reflection on that, that for some of the folks who are still left in churches, it's their primary, social interaction. And that's extremely important. And, you know, the disastrous way that we've dealt with the pandemic and creating this separation for so long, you know, it's legitimately really hard for a lot of people.
Patricia, my churches have distributed over 7,000 boxes of fresh food to rural Oklahoma. It's in contact in a drive-through with those who may never enter a church.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that's the thing, as Mark, you were just saying a minute ago. I mean, there's a lot of suffering that's not being taken care of in our society. I mean, I hope that that's not a new idea to people. And there are many, many ways that communities, whether we call them churches or I don't really care what we call them, frankly, can be helping with, could be helping with. But it really takes that kind of moral, spiritual imagination to say, this is what we're really called to do. We're excited about this. We want to be caring and loving. And yeah, whether that's food, whether that's mental health, whether that's spiritual practice, whether that's, I mean, there's all kinds of things. And you know, just because the church isn't sponsoring somebody, you know, getting a cast on their leg after they break their leg, doesn't mean that there aren't many opportunities. And you know, my hope is that after the pandemic, there are at least some groups and communities that start thinking more about that in a really imaginative kind of way. Mm-hmm.
Adam writes, did the church really stop though, or did it just buy in and go for profit? There are sure a lot of religious names of hospitals.
Yeah, there are a lot of names. Very few of those are owned by church bodies anymore.
Oftentimes they got turned over because they couldn't maintain, like they declined, so there weren't enough nuns to run the hospital. It was getting too big, and so they turned it over.
Yeah.
But I don't know of any that are still like making income from these hospital things for their other diocese stuff. I don't know if that's really common anymore or not. I
guess I don't know. It's not.
It doesn't seem like it would be. Len writes, my local church here in Canada has also put a focus on local church security as well as good sovereignty, reconciliation, and support of local farms. That's cool.
Yeah, food security. Great.
Adam writes, you can hardly call the medical industrial complex a nursing work either. No, once there's profit, like profit is.
That's
profit
a whole
is
other.
The goal. That's a whole other topic, but it's like, you're not. Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of this fascinating thing. What, you know, Mark, what you're talking about the, you know, several people have raised the money issue. I mean, once the people that work in your hospital have not taken a vow of poverty, there's a whole other thing that starts to happen, and we don't have time to talk about that right now.
Sean says, I see more larger congregations using their money to pool together funds and then give big chunks to those orgs they affirm, or paying off large medical debts, etc. That could seem short-lived. I've seen that too. I would wonder if anyone studied that as a trend, because I've only heard of a few. Doesn't mean that there aren't more.
Yeah.
I don't know how prevalent it is, but to me, that is a great model. Like churches exploring different jubilee. I know of a church that has taken care of paying off some of its workers' student debt, not for everyone else in the congregation, but like those little things could definitely be built upon.
Yeah, I mean, I think all these examples that you all have lifted up are really great, and they are outliers. It's very minority kind of activity. And I think it's really important to pay attention to and go, oh, wow, like these are all some cool possibilities. All right. Gus,
I think you get the
last word.
A friend talks about how some rural churches are the last closest thing to a public commons. I shudder to think what it'll be like when those places close and get bought out by private developers. That's true. That's how I experienced the rural church. Is that was the place where you gather. Like there's no other place you'd hang out together except for if you were a sinner and went to a bar. That's kind of how bars were like the enemy of the church in small town. So
yeah, I think it's a chicken and egg kind of thing. I mean, to some extent that's true. But then one of the reasons they're closing is because fewer and fewer people are wanting to use them as a commons, because culturally we don't like commons, right? We like private property. So yeah. All right, well, thanks everyone. This has been great to hear from you all, and stay safe. We love you. See you next time.
See you next time.